And you can also find the chat room there. ScottHorton.org/chat if you want to hang out with the boys and girls in there during the show and other times, too. Say hi to each other. Share links. Talk about El Caminos. Whatever you're into. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. At Scott Horton Show. If you want to do that. So, follow me and retweet me. All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Today on the show, Phil Giraldi is going to be here to talk about Israeli spies in America. Israeli spies in America. Israeli spies in America. Well, we talked with Jeff Stein, what, earlier this week? Last week? When was that? Monday? Friday? At some point recently, Jeff Stein was on the show. And good old Jeff Stein, he's a hell of a reporter and an analyst. And a lot of times he says things like, oh no, a terrible thing is going on. Look, here's how it goes. And honestly, I'm doing a check disc and I can't even check my damn email. But I did see on my phone that he sent a new article out. And I'm going to read it in one of these breaks before it's time to interview him. Maybe I'll read it while he's talking instead of listening. But I know it's about the Iran talks. Yeah, this check disc, I can't believe how long it's taking. But I think that antiwar.com is the most important thing on the internet. What are we going to do without antiwar.com? We have to have antiwar.com. And just now they start up their fundraising drive and they got one of their servers hacked yesterday. It's fixed now. Every last bit of any threat to your browser has been removed. And Mozilla and Google got right on it and started blocking the offending pages immediately. And antiwar.com got right on it. And they got rid of all the malware, whatever. It's all perfectly safe. If you ever did go to antiwar.com/donate, that's on a completely separate secure server in a completely separate location and never was threatened in any way. But here it is. It's the middle of their fund drive, and they've got, oh no, malware warning all over a bunch of their pages. So I believe that Google Chrome and Mozilla Firefox have begun at least taking down their warnings and all that. I hope that they've gotten that fixed by now. The front page was always okay, but it was the WordPress blogs at antiwar.com, the original, the news, and the blog that got messed up. However, it's all good now. It's all fixed now. It's completely malware-free now. And they sure could use your support. At antiwar.com/donate. It's their fundraising drive, and this is me. You know, it's partially for me, but still, it's, you know. Overall, say I won the lottery, I would donate to antiwar.com, and I would still ask you to donate to antiwar.com, because we got to have antiwar.com. I, by the way, would retire. Okay, I do a show once a week. But I would donate to antiwar.com, because we got to have antiwar.com. If you know what I mean. So, help out if you can. And I know it's not easy for everybody, and I'm not asking you to, you know, go pawn your jewelry. But if you can, then those of us who can't sure would prefer, or sure would appreciate your support, I mean to say, so that we can have antiwar.com. All right. I wonder who it was who hacked him. They said that I talked with Eric Garrison. That's the boss there. And he said that it looks like the attack may have originated from Ukraine. Although that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Sorry, I had to yawn, but not in your ear. Then again, I could see why some Ukrainians might not like antiwar.com that much. Per recently. Speaking of Ukraine, until the break, I'm going to babble about Ukraine for a minute. I think it's time that the Americans announce they have no further interest in Ukraine whatsoever. They do not support the Kiev coup d'etat junta in any way. They will not loan it any money. They will not bring it into the European Union. They will not even think about bringing it into NATO, and they're done. We love you, Ukraine. Good luck to you. Goodbye. And then that's it. And you know why? Because the American government has got, say it with me now, no right at all to do anything otherwise. That's it. It's as simple as that. And yes, I know it's the American government's responsibility that they did this coup and put these guys in power, but you're going to have to stab them in the back and leave them high and dry at some point. The sooner the better. High and dry. Goodbye, Svoboda. Goodbye, Privy Sector. You guys go, Nazis salute each other to death. And leave everybody else alone. Goodbye, Gas Princess Timoshenko, the most corrupt person in the Eastern Hemisphere. Goodbye, the likes of you. Sort out your worries the best you can. By all means, the East should, the West should declare independence from the East if they think they can get away with it. But it should not be the American government's responsibility anymore. And who in the world could even imagine at this point that American interference in Eastern Europe is to the benefit of anyone's security at all? You know? It's like if the people of Oz went and picked a gigantic fight with the entire race of flying monkeys on the pretense that the Wizard of Oz was really magic and was gonna, you know, make sure that they win at the end. But then, no, it's all just a hoax. They picked themselves a fight that they can't win. So step back. Not a very good metaphor, but I'm trying. So that's it. And if the Russians retake Eastern Ukraine all the way down to Odessa, that would be sad. You know, to think that all those, sex slaves, that the business in their trade would be taken over by a different group of mobsters. It's just, heartbreaking. And if they took over the west of Ukraine too, throw in the Baltics and Poland. Tough. What are you going to do? Go to nuclear war over it? If you're not really going to go to thermonuclear war over it, then why bluff? Why the pretense?
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, where I do my show. We're on APSRadioNews.com, APSRadioNews.com, DailyPaulRadio.com, scotthorton.org, AnomalyRadio.com goes in there, too. Yeah. All right, good. So, my friend Phil sent me, keep biting my cheek, man, it makes it hard to talk. My friend Phil sent me an article this morning by this dimwit right-wing jerk, was it Cliff Kincaid, I think. Ugh. It's tough for me, man, it's stressful for me, to read such blatant dishonesty. The article was about how, I bet you Edward Snowden is a traitor and a spy, and that makes Glenn Greenwald his accomplice in espionage and all this crap. And I'm thinking, really? Is this the best that you can do? No evidence whatsoever, just, he's in Russia, huh?
He links in there to Edward J. Epstein at the Wall Street Journal saying, oh, yeah, you know what I wonder? Question mark. In the title. Question mark. Oh, I wonder if maybe the guy could possibly be a traitor. What do you guys think? What? And then what's the evidence that Edward Snowden, rather than being a whistleblower, is actually a turned traitor, secret agent of the Russians and or Chinese? Maybe both at the very same time, dude. What's the evidence for that? Well, he went to Hong Kong and now he's in Russia. Oh, man. Are you guys just trying to wear me out or what? He was on his way to Commie Cuba, as long as you want to smear him. He was on his way to Commie Cuba when Barack Obama stripped him of his passport and left him stranded in Russia. Now, I know that it would be the truth, and therefore not interesting, to make a talking point out of Obama stranded this computer genius who knows all this stuff in Russia, and that makes Obama a traitor. As much as Republicans and conservatives hate Barack Obama, they're not going to attack him about something that's actually true or meaningful. Something has to be a damned lie for them to go for it. A damned lie like, hey, look, everybody, Snowden's in Russia under the control of Vladimir Putin. Ah, ipso facto. Hop, skip, and a jump from, I betcha he must have been working for Putin all along. Yes, and he's only pretending to be a whistleblower, and that was why he went through all the trouble of getting Poitras and Greenwald to come to Hong Kong. It was because he needed them as cover for, you know, the foolish lie that he's really a whistleblower and not a traitor. But what does he care if he's headed to Russia anyway? Why wouldn't he just go to Russia and give all the stuff to the Russians? So that he can be the world's greatest traitor, only go down in history as a whistleblower anyway? This is so stupid. Cliff Kincaid is so stupid. But it isn't him, right? This is the right-wing morning email. I need to get on that list somehow. The Republican morning email. Where every day the challenge is not to make Edward Snowden look bad, to make Glenn Greenwald look bad, to make telling the truth about the crimes the government commits look at, like a bad thing to do. The challenge every day is, let's have a contest and see just how stupid American conservatives are. Let's see what they can't be made to believe. Hey, you idiots. How about you just forget that you already know that it was Obama that stranded Snowden in Russia, and you just go ahead and pretend like you believe that he was working for Russia all along, because we say so, you idiot. Now drop and give me 20. You pathetic idiots. Quote, direct quote from Karl Rove, right? This is the Republican talking point of the day. Like on Trading Places. I bet you a dollar we could convince American conservatives to all blow the backs of their own skulls out as the only way to stop Hillary Clinton from bringing the Mexican homosexual army to invade and give Ukraine to the Crimea. Huh? Why not? Why not? What can't they be made to believe? Now, here's Hillary Clinton. Do I have to start going down the list of actual reasons why any decent person would detest this woman? Hillary Clinton, the most terrible person in North America outside of any official office right now. But no, you know what? Let's try this as a contest, as an experiment, our daily dollar bet. What stupid idiocy can we not get conservatives to believe? How about when she fell and hit her head that she has permanent brain damage now and is therefore not fit to be president? Yeah, you know, we can't think about of anything actually that she stands for different than the Republican Party. They don't have anything to actually challenge her on. Oh, the war in Libya? No, they love that. The war for Al-Qaeda in Libya and in Syria? No, they love that. calling Putin Hitler and trying to, you know, head off the possibility of negotiation there, just like she did over and over again with Iran. They love that. Fascist healthcare schemes, they love that. They love everything about Hillary Clinton. Legal abortion, they love that. Come on, don't pretend for a minute that the Republican Party wants to change the abortion laws. Under George Bush, at least at first, under Junior, they controlled the presidency, both houses of Congress, and the Supreme Court, and they didn't even try to do a thing about it. They need that as a political issue. Otherwise, you might be a Democrat because they're exactly like the Republicans, only they'll give you more welfare. So, they need that as an issue. They don't want to solve it. They need it as an issue. So here they have nothing to attack her for. They can't disagree with anything. And never mind the fact that this demon woman, this blood-soaked monster, this shadow of death and fear and destruction, could outwit any Republican in the audience that Karl Rove is trying to convince that she's got brain damage. Hey, you brain-damaged idiots. Here's this woman whose IQ is 40 points better than yours. And yeah, she's got brain damage. And you're stupid enough to believe that. Go ahead and believe it. And then I bet you they do. I bet they got Frank Luntz to do like some awesome algorithm where they go and troll through. You know, like those pages where they go through looking for people who believe Onion articles and get outraged about them, you know? Go trolling through Facebook with the algorithm looking to see the percentage success. And how many conservatives can they get to just repeat the most ridiculous talking points in the whole wide world? The most evil woman in the whole wide world? The problem with her is not that she's evil. It's not actually a thing that she's ever done wrong or a thing she believes. The problem with her is that she fell and hit her head. There, you stupid idiots. Now drop and give me 20 and then crawl on your bellies and then go repeat that on Facebook because we said so. Cry the leaders of American conservatism. It's amazing to me. It's the ultimate in social psychology experiments. What's the problem with Barack Obama? Oh, not that he's a half-white, conservative, Republican, corporatist, imperialist, nationalist, blood-soaked, aggressive, warmongering killer, liar, Patriot Act enforcer, Guantanamo and Bagram and Somalia torturer. No, the problem is that he was born in Kenya and he's a Black Panther Marxist with an afro from Chicago who has the exact same radical left monetary policy as George W. Bush. Oh, wait, no, that part would be accurate, so that can't go in the narrative. It's got to all be completely wrong for conservatives to believe in it, to repeat it to each other, to tell each other how smart they are for agreeing with each other about what they don't know anything about at all. I should write a book.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest up today is Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer. And he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and uns.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott.
Good deal. Happy to have you back. And I'm sorry I don't have your article in front of me anymore because I'm running a check disk and it's taken forever. But I read it this morning, and it's all about Israeli spying. I don't remember the title, sorry, but it's uns.com, UNZ.com, brand new by Phil Giraldi, about Israeli spying and about Jeff Stein's two pieces in Newsweek about Israeli spying and a great deal about Palestine as well. So I guess let's start with, you want to start with the failed talks here and what it all means?
Well, it's all part of one story. I mean, the failed talks are a symptom of the dysfunctional foreign policy in the Middle East, and Israeli spying is kind of the underhanded side of that story, that the Israelis, while torpedoing the talks, and I think it's become very clear that the White House and State Department are blaming the Israelis for the first time ever. The Israelis have continued to spy on us, and this is basically impacting on other aspects of Middle Eastern policy.
Right. Yeah, well, let's talk about that, the first time ever that the White House has been so blatant. They always say, oh, Arafat should have accepted the greatest deal ever, without really describing what it was he rejected. Because once you get to the details, it wasn't that great of an offer after all. But we can always expect that kind of spin. But in this case, it really was sort of blatant, where really the consensus, even in all the Israeli papers and the American ones, and among, as you mentioned, among the president and the secretary of state as well, is that, hey, the Israelis blew it this time.
Yeah, what basically happened was that the apparently Kerry had worked out some kind of preliminary deal with the Palestinians, and the Israelis appeared to be going along with it. And the very morning that of the day when they would have been announcing that they were moving forward, the Israelis announced 700 new houses in East Jerusalem, which basically destroyed any possibility of a deal. And then there were other things too. Obviously, there have been a number of stories I'm sure you've read in the Israeli media about Netanyahu. Apparently has a long history of doing this sort of thing, you know, creeping up to the point where he can talk the talk like he's interested in peace, but then doing something that he knows will end the talks right there. So it's kind of interesting to see this. Everybody now is apart from the very strong partisans of Israel in the United States, everybody now has kind of figured out, hey, this is not really as much a Palestinian problem as it is an Israeli problem.
Right. Well, and the thing of it is, too, is it really drives home that the U.S. doesn't necessarily even have to stop them from doing what they're doing. We just have to stop covering for them all the time, because everyone else in the world's against them at this point. They would, without American diplomatic cover and, of course, monetary and military subsidy, they would have to figure out an entirely different foreign policy, almost certainly not including a continuing occupation of the West Bank.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the funny side stories of this, which I think you probably saw today, was apparently the guy who leaked all this stuff about the Israelis being the ones that torpedoed it was Martin Indyk. And there couldn't be a stronger partisan in the world for Israel than Martin Indyk, chief U.S. negotiator who was basically has been accused of being leaning towards Israel in everything he does. But he realizes that unless the Israelis seize the opportunity to create a two states, it's going to become a binational state eventually. It's got to happen. And then if anybody wanted a Jewish identity for the state of Israel, it's going to be gone. So Indyk has understood this, and somehow Benjamin Netanyahu can't quite get it.
Right. Yeah, he even gave a speech the other day. I'm trying to remember who originally quoted it, but then Laura Rosen provided the footnote. She was there as well, the investigative reporter Laura Rosen. So whoever it was that originally tweeted it, it was, she was verifying it. Was it Landay? It wasn't Landay. Anyway, and then, that was the quote, was just outright, hey, Simple as simple could be, it was the Israeli side that ruined the deal this time, and it's really too damn bad. And now, Martin Indyk, for people not familiar, he goes back with the Israel lobby in America. He helped found the Washington Institute for Near East Policy for them back in the 80s, right?
That's correct, yeah. He's an AIPAC guy all the way. And for him to come out with this shows the level of frustration that the administration is feeling about the positions that Israel is taking. It's quite astonishing, you know, but then again, you know, we have Congress to deal with, we have the media to deal with. It's not exactly like suddenly we woke up this morning and everything has changed. It hasn't.
Well, that's the thing. I was just about to ask you, how can the Israeli policy be so self-destructive for so long in a row like this? But then you said Congress, and that's the answer, right? They are confident that the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. has enough of a control over Congress that nothing is ever going to get too far out of hand as far as America protecting whatever it is they perceive their interest to be.
Yeah, clearly Congress is still in the pocket of the Israel lobby. There's not going to be any shift on that for the foreseeable future unless we have a dramatic change in who gets elected in November, but I don't see that. And you know, it's the same old story that basically interest groups in the United States, whatever they are, whether it's an interest group for Israel or for various other interest groups, they wield a tremendous amount of power because they control the contributions to the congressmen, and they control re-election.
Now that the narrative is changing, do you think that power dynamic is going to change at all? Because, you know, the whole mythology about, you know, the poor Israelis are besieged by the Palestinians and all of that kind of thing, or at least every time, I mean, that's more for the rubes, but at least in D.C., the narrative is always that it's all the Palestinians' fault that they can't ever get their act together enough for the Israelis to deal with them well or whatever. But since that narrative is falling away, I wonder if just, you know, cash and threats and those kind of politics will be enough to keep all of Congress in line when it's just becoming more and more apparent to everyone, as John Kerry put it to the Trilateral Commission, hey, we're dealing with an apartheid state, or we're on the verge of having an apartheid state under this, under the definition of, you know, minority rule, I think he meant.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the I've written about this too, where there's been a dramatic shift in terms of perceptions, and that after a certain point is going to, you know, the way Israel behaves and everything is not going to be sustainable. But the other interesting aspect of this is of course the other half of my story about the spying, because these spying stories came out basically for the first time in the mainstream media. Now, that's the important thing. It's in the mainstream media, Newsweek, and it was picked up in a number of other places. And this is because Israel was pushing to get this visa waiver for Israelis so they could travel freely to the United States. And the intelligence community and the defense community went to Congress in closed session and said this would be a disaster. Israel spies on us more than anybody. And they provided all the details. Again, this was a closed, you know, confidential session. It provided all the details to such an extent that apparently, according to Jeff Stein, who wrote the articles, the congressmen and their staffers, all of whom, to a man and woman, were pro-Israeli, were shocked, were stunned. So this all came out, and the result is going to be, so it seems, that the intelligence community, defense community, national security community, all united on this. They're saying if you open the door to Israelis coming here, we're going to have a huge problem like 9/11, when we had art students and Israeli intelligence officers operating all over the United States. That would come back. And that's basically what they're saying. And it's going to be very difficult for Congress to try to get this waiver through. They're still trying. But the fact is, it's Israel, every time it turns around lately, is making its own worst case. And that's what we're seeing.
Yep. Well, you know, it's a great thing, too, that it's Jeff Stein that did this reporting. As you mentioned, it's in Newsweek, because that's where he is now. I mean, he used to write for Congressional Quarterly back when he broke the Harmon story, which is great stuff, you know, along these same lines. But who the hell reads Congressional Quarterly unless you're really into this kind of thing about, you know, what Israeli spies are caught doing on the phone around here, what Jane Harmon's up to. It didn't really get that much play, but now that he's writing at Newsweek, that's a lot bigger footprint, even in the latest version of it. And then in the Israeli press, they try to resort to saying, it was an Israeli politician, I forget who, I don't think it was Netanyahu, but one of his ministers was quoted saying, well, there's a whiff of anti-Semitism here, as though, you know, Jeff Stein is either an anti-Semite himself or just way too dull to figure out that these intelligence community briefers and the staffers who receive their briefings are all just a bunch of closet Nazis, which is why they would make up these atrocious lies. And all that, I thought, was so silly that it only just bolstered the case that, you know, we're talking about Jeff Stein here. You point out in your article, I didn't realize that he's a former military intelligence officer himself. I certainly knew that he's a very credible intelligence beat reporter, and they dare not attack his credibility as a journalist, but trying to they try to at least imply that, well, at least the guys he's talking to must be anti-Semites or something, but I don't think that stuck this time. He's too good.
They tried to go after Paul Pillar, the former CIA officer, because he's quoted by Jeff Stein. And, of course, Pillar's credentials are impeccable. He's never been an Israel basher. And so a number of Israeli publications and some publications in the U.S. also, they went after him. And the great thing about Stein was he had his first article, which talked about the Israeli spying, how it was connected with this visa waiver program. And then he followed it up when they started attacking him with another article.
Yeah, about their cover-ups. You know, now hold it right there. Yeah, I'm sorry, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Phil Giraldi in just a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi, formerly a CIA and DIA officer. And now he writes for the American Conservative and for UNZ.com. That's UNZ.com, where he's got a brand new piece about Israeli spying in America. And it's, as we've been talking about, half the story of the failed last round, and I mean last round, of the so-called two-state solution, peace talks there in Israel, as well as the other part of that same story, Israeli political influence in America. Not just do they spy on the U.S. Military and industrial-wise, economic-wise, and all that, but they do so with absolute impunity year in and year out due to that same political power that they pull in Washington, D.C. And so I'm often reminded, and I was mentioning this the other day to the people, of Christopher Ketchum's great piece for Counterpunch, which you're featured in as a source, Phil, that begins, "Scratch a former intelligence officer, and he'll start talking to you about Israeli spying in America." In other words, that's what you are all just chomping at the bit, waiting to say, if someone will give you a chance to tell us what we don't know about what the Israeli government is really up to in America. Because they know they'll always get away with it, and the story will never really be told. So let us know. Enlighten us, Phil. What's it like?
Well, I mean, basically, Israeli spying on the United States is the most massive spying program directed against the United States by anyone. You know, back in the old days when we had the Soviet Union as an adversary, and sure, they spied on us, but they were pretty limited in terms of what they could do. They would send in an occasional illegal if they could come up with one. They had their KGB and GRU officers operating out of embassies and consulates, But we're not talking about a whole lot of people. We're not talking about a massive successful effort. The only real successes they had were volunteers who were Americans that volunteered to spy for the Soviet Union. So let's put that in context. The Israelis, however, have been spying on us since before the creation of the State of Israel. So, or rather the proxies of the Israelis since they didn't exist. But they've been spying on us for like 60 years. And the fact is that they have stolen nuclear secrets, defense secrets, military technologies, commercial technologies that had military and industrial applications. They've stolen just about everything from us. Plus, they have penetrated a lot of our communication systems, as Christopher Ketchum has described. So the fact is, the Israeli spying to us is not a joke. I mean, this is an incredible, massive effort to basically shift elements of our economy and our military technologies to Israel, to benefit Israel. And that's what it's all about. And intelligence officers have known this for years. They've known just the extent to which Israelis turn up everywhere. And, of course, Jeff Stein points out in his second article, when they get caught, they don't even get slapped on the wrist. They get no punishment, and this has been known to counterintelligence people at FBI and CIA people and everybody and people at the Pentagon and everybody else, and yet the Israelis get away with it, and they get away with it, and they get away with it, basically because the U.S. government, as Congress and the White House, are afraid to take them on.
It really is incredible that, you know, when you have. Well, if you're me and you have access to former CIA people and can give them a chance to complain about how this works and what they know, the contrast between what I understand about this now, just from knowing people like you and Ray McGovern and others and reading my Christopher Ketchum, which, you know, most people don't, the contrast between that and what I perceive to be at least the common narrative of what people understand about this, it's absolutely night and day. I think most people, if they considered it, if you asked them, they might say, well, yeah, I guess they must spy on us some or something. But for most people, it's never come up. The question, the subject has never been brought up at any moment in their lives. It's just not part of life in America that we discuss Israeli spying. It's just not part of anyone's narrative outside of such very few channels. And yet, as you explain, it's absolutely systematic and goes far beyond whatever anybody else would be able to. Right, the Soviets would never be able to get away with that because they were our enemies at the time. But the Israelis, they can basically, visa program or no, they can just run wild across America all day long and nobody's checking on them because they're our friends. It's almost the assumption is that, you know, hey, we're all gentlemen and friends here, and they wouldn't spy on us that much, would they? Because what if we got mad at them? And yet they know that we won't. And so that's the thing of it, is they go far beyond what people would assume would be their stopping point because of fears that we would clamp down on just what they're able to get away with if they go too far, you know?
Yeah, well, it's some of the stuff that Jeff Stein came out with were things that I knew, but, you know, basically the way he pulled it together was beautiful. I mean, he described how the Secret Service agent was in Tel Aviv. Do you remember that part? And he was on the toilet. They had just cleared the hotel room suite that Al Gore, vice president, was supposed to be using. And he heard a scratching noise, and here was an Israeli intelligence officer coming through the air vent on what he thought was an empty room. Obviously, he was going to be putting in recording devices and other things. And you know, this kind of stuff is just
Well, and funny and there, he just coughed and said, like, hey, buddy, I'm here, so keep hiding,
yeah.
Instead of, like, hey,
yeah.
I'm calling you out, get out of here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then Stein also, you know, recounts how when American scientists, American scientists, academics, are invited to conferences over in Israel, and then, you know, and they go, and when they go there, they're pitched. They try to recruit them. If they think that the guy is vulnerable to to women. They'll send women into his room if they think he likes drugs. They'll ply him with drugs. They'll ply him with alcohol. All the classic kind of things you do to, like I would have done when I was in the CIA, to a KGB guy or something. You look for the vulnerabilities. But these are Americans. These are American officials. These are American academics. Massive programs by the Israelis to recruit these people and get them and get their information. I mean, it's just incredible. I recommend everybody read the two articles, the two Newsweek articles. The first one is great, and the second one in some ways is even better, where it describes how there's never any retribution for any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And think about it. You know, we've been taking a hosing now for so many years, and how long is this supposed to go on?
Yeah, indefinitely, I guess. I talked with John Cole, the former FBI counterintelligence officer. I think you mentioned him in your speech at the recent reassessing the special relationship conference there, where he said on this show that he knew of right around, or maybe it was exactly that he had counted them up or something, I don't know, but somewhere right around at least 150 counterintelligence cases that at least were contemplated, if not actually begun, and then shut down for political reasons. So it would be,
yeah,
you know, 0.1% of these ever go anywhere at all, and that's if you count Rosen and Weissman ultimately getting away with it.
Yeah, yeah. And another interesting thing in the Stein article was how, you know, the State Department does threat assessments about the whole world, every country. They're mandated to do this every year. And they're afraid to write an honest threat assessment about traveling to Israel, because they don't want to piss Israel's friends in Congress off. Because if they write an accurate assessment saying, look, if you have access to classified information, if you're a scientist who works in technical areas that are of interest, you're going to be approached by Israeli intelligence officers. They're afraid to write that. You keep thinking, my God, how do you get this across to these lunkhead Christian Zionists who claim to be patriotic Americans that were being raped by the Israelis? And we've been raped by the Israelis for years and years and years now. But I guess you can't get it across to them because they think God is on their side. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. It's the kind of thing where if this was a movie or a TV show or something, somewhere there's an adult who puts a stop to this stuff, rather than it just goes on and on and on with no accountability for anyone whatsoever. I mean, at least somebody at the FBI ought to be in trouble for continuing to let this go or something.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's no adult supervision over the U.S. government at all, but I think you and I figured that out about 10 years ago.
Well, that's the real problem here, is the evil conspirators built a world empire that nobody can control, so it's all just up for grabs, and squeaky wheel gets the grease, I think is the best way to put it. And the Israel lobby, they're just relentless. You kind of got to, like Stephen Walt says, you kind of got to respect them for using the democratic process in the most efficient and effective way possible. You know, I mean, I envy them as a peacenik. If only every peacenik in America could really be motivated to make the phone calls, to send the emails, to meet with their congressman, to follow up, to vow to never support that congressman again, or to always support that one, or always support that one's enemy, or whatever it is, the way the Israel lobby do. They just have their act together. And it's most of it is not illegal as far as their control of the Congress. It's just ugly as hell, you know? But they do a good job, Phil. I don't know. It's terrible, but it's great for them. All right. Well, thanks very much. You scare the hell out of me again.
Right. Bye-bye.
Phil Giraldi, everybody. He's at UNZ.com, UNZ.com, in the American Conservative Magazine. Hey, Al Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. All right, you all. I'm Scott. This is my show. I can't read you nothing because my computer's still doing a check disk. God dang, it's taking a long time to do a check disk. You know, it doesn't seem like it's found anything wrong. If there was anything wrong, it would have found it by now, probably, right? This is the very last file needed rewriting or something? Oh, hell, I don't know. But I'm Scott, and this is my show. Thanks for tuning in. And I'm sorry to bring up old stuff, but today on TV and in New York, it's 9/11 day again. And that's because they've opened up the museum in New York now. And so the first and most important and most relevant thing I think I have to say about that is damn Barack Obama standing up there talking about boo-hoo for Al-Qaeda attack on America when he is the greatest friend of Ayman al-Zawahiri and his legions on the planet today, and everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. Oh, no, we're only backing the moderates. Yeah, all the money and all the guns that we send to Syria end up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, our former enemies from the last war across the border there. And both groups are sworn agents of al-Qaeda and Ayman al-Zawahiri. Although you might quibble and say, no, ISIS has broken off from Ayman al-Zawahiri. Not that they're any better. They're actually worse than the al-Nusra Front when it comes to suicide attacks against civilians and beheading their prisoners, etc. like that. And they've defied Zawahiri, who's told them to go back to Iraq and fight in Iraq. And they've told him, screw you, what are you going to do about it? Like he's going to court-martial them or something from a basement in Pakistan. So they told him, screw you, old man, and they're doing whatever they want to do. And if anything, they're worse than the al-Nusra Front, which after all, they turned David Enders loose. Remember that? They kidnapped our friend David Enders, and then they let him live and set him free. They weren't made to either. They did it. They didn't. It wasn't a negotiation from the outside either, I don't believe. I think they just turned him loose. I'm trying to remember now. But anyway, they're loyal to the goals of al-Qaeda. They're sworn to be loyal to al-Qaeda, and Obama's backing their rebellion in Syria. If he had to intervene in Syria at all, assuming that false premise of American intervention, then the right thing to do would be back the Ba'athist secular regime against the al-Qaeda suicide bombers. Or at least to look the other way. To think that they are backing the al-Nusra Front and ISIS. Oh no, they're only arming up the moderate rebels. Come on. And you know, Jonathan Landay was on a show and he was there and I respect him and I respect his journalism. And he said he met the FSA rebels in Turkey and in Jordan. At least in Jordan. And yeah, they really exist. And yeah, they really aren't bin Ladenites. They're just Sunnis who hate Assad and want to fight him. And just because they're militant doesn't mean that they're, you know, suicide bombers and prisoner beheaders. And he's right about that. But what are their numbers and what's their influence compared to the al-Qaeda guys? Landay himself reported that, yes, he agreed with what David Enders had said. That, yeah, man, this is al-Qaeda's war. That was what he was on the show to say. Yeah, okay, you know, he was basically, you know, trying to, well, maybe accurately was isolating American direct support is going to these moderates. But still, it ain't their war. They're on the same side as the suicide bombers, but they're not the ones getting it done. And they don't always keep their hands on the weapons and the money that they get. In fact, the rule is otherwise. That whatever they get from the West, from our allies, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Jordanians, ends up in the hands of the most effective fighters. And those tend to be the guys who aren't afraid of dying. The true believers willing to take the most risks. And anyway, so here Barack Obama is backing guys. Look, there's really no way to spin this. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton herself, I'd play the soundbite for you, but my computer is still running a check disk. But you can find it at CBS News. Her interview from the spring of 2 years ago, 2012, where the guy says, why aren't we doing enough to help the rebels? And she says, look, Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda support the rebellion in Syria. Hamas supports the rebels in Syria. And so, if we are supporting the rebels in Syria, are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Are we supporting Hamas? And she asked it rhetorically like that, but she was very clearly saying that That is, in effect, what we would be doing. And, of course, she's also the same lady who made it known after the first term was over and she was left the regime, the Obama regime, and was replaced by Kerry. She was the one, and it was clear at the time, and I don't believe disputed at the time, she was the one who put it in the New York Times that, yeah, me and Panetta and Petraeus wanted to back the rebels more and better, but Obama wouldn't let us. He's a coward. I'm tougher than him. She wanted to make sure and get that out there, that he would not grant her wish to go ahead and do exactly what she warned against, support a rebellion which is made up of people who are not loyal to American goals, but are loyal to bin Ladenite goals. There's no other way to put it. This is the bin Ladenite dream come true. It's also the American military-industrial complex's dream come true, too, if they want to keep drone wars going and airstrikes and what have you, special forces wars going in the Middle East forever and you know, keep up the welfare to Israel and Jordan and Saudi and everybody else, and they can do that based on this. But for Obama to sit there and pretend that he cares about the people who died on 9/11 kind of pisses me off a little bit. And you know what? That's a very real thing to me, and I know that they beat it to death, man. 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. It's, you know, as Biden said, making fun of Giuliani, a noun, a verb, a 9/11. Blah, blah, blah. It becomes just numbers and a dash on a page. It becomes just a phrase, a term that you heard a million times. But, you know, my wife could have died in that thing. She had an office in one of those towers. The only reason that she didn't die that day was because she was deathly ill. And so was out of town, recuperating from her terrible illness. But her neighbors died there, and her friends died there, and she most certainly would have died if she had been there. Her office was too high up. I forget, 78th floor or something like that? And I forget which tower. I don't know. It was before I knew her. But anyway. So that was a very real thing to her and to her friends that died in it and her friends that survived it. And all of that, and it's not hard for me to remember that time and how very real it was and whatever. So I'm trying to think of it in those terms of the real event, not all the PR, not the exploitation and all the lies and all the, sloughed off responsibility. Is that the right term for it? It sounded good to me when I said it in my brain before I said it, whatever. Sloughed off. Sounds kind of casual, doesn't it? The responsibility for who all did it and how they got away with it. Who didn't stop them. And anyway, you know what George W. Bush, and I'm sorry I said this over and over again, but I'm really good about it. I'm right. And you have to admit, what Bush did in invading Iraq and kicking the Sunnis out of power and helping the Badr Brigade kick them out of Baghdad, and anyway, fighting that war for years and years and years and turning all that land from Fallujah to Tikrit to Mosul and the rest of the so-called Anbar province, Sunni triangle, etc., turning all that into lawless jihadistan was absolutely, as Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, put it, the hoped-for but unexpected gift to bin Laden. Not only are you going to invade and regime change and stay in Afghanistan, exactly what he was trying to get you to do, but you're going to double down and do it in Iraq, too, and get rid of the secular fascist socialist dictator. That was what bin Laden said on the eve of the war. He said, Iraqis, rise up against the Americans and Saddam Hussein, the evil fascist socialist infidel. You might have think that if Bush cared at all, he might have called off the war right then. Whoa, wait, what? But nah, anyway, he didn't care. So they had the war, and that was it. It amounted to treason. The pure stupidity of going along with the Cheney-Sharon plan for regime change in Baghdad. Absolutely the best thing that anyone could have ever done for al-Qaeda. But how does that compare to perhaps lesser interventions up front in Libya and Syria that have still amounted to direct support? Direct support for the bin Ladenite movements. I mean, it was known during the war all through. Go check the archives of this show all through 2011. Patrick Coburn was there in Libya. Other reporters, the what's his name from the New Yorker was there. All these reporters, David Enders from McClatchy was there saying, hey, these are the Mujahideen. Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, went on CNN and said, look, if we were fighting this, if these guys were at war anywhere else, we would call them the Mujahideen. These are the Sunni extremists. These are Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they are, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia. We knew that during the regime change. It took them 9 months to airstrike Gaddafi and special forces Gaddafi out of there. And that whole time, there was blah, 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 Hasidi in the Telegraph in London saying, yeah, I'm a former Al-Qaeda and Iraq guy. Yeah, you know, we fought against the Americans there, but we appreciate your help now. And then same thing for Abdul Hakim al-Belhaj, who had actually been renditioned and tortured by the CIA and MI6 and had been handed over to Gaddafi for being an Al-Qaeda guy. Now we're fighting a war for him. And then doubling, tripling, quadrupling, or worse, the exact same policy in Syria on behalf of the suicide bombers. There's no higher treason than that imaginable. Until Jeb comes.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you all. I'm Scott. This is my show. I'm getting old, man. My y'alls are becoming you alls more and more as I get older and tireder. I've got a nicotine deficiency. That's what it is. I quit smoking a couple and a half years ago or so, and I ain't really been right in the head since. I'm working on it, though. All right. Hey, here's more things to say about this 9/11 museum thing. I'll try to be brief. I went on too long last time, last segment. A couple more things about it. I really think that perhaps it's in bad taste now to go on with the self-indulgence and the ceremonies and the flailing and the flogging and the martyrdom and all of that. And I think that as horrible as what happened there was and always will be, that on one hand, as unfair as this is, the U.S. government kind of blew it. And they murdered so many innocent people under the excuse of avenging that attack that it just is, I think, really kind of crass and ugly to sit there and carry on like we're still the world's greatest victims just because our government has the budget to build the world's greatest museum to what victims we are. The U.S. government and the civil war it caused, but most of the deaths were at the hands of the Americans, but and including the civil war and the different militias killing each other on both sides and all that in the Iraq war, killed somewhere between 500,000 and a million people, much more likely toward the high end of that because, you know, the studies, the high-end studies, they were never able to even get to Fallujah. They were never even able to get to the worst parts of Mosul and ask people who really bore the brunt of the war how bad it was in their neighborhood, in their family. Those places were still off limits, the places with the worst casualties. So I think, you know, if you look at opinion business research, that's probably a conservative estimate. And damn, we can build a fancy museum and memorial and gigantic World Trade Center-sized tombstone to the dead there. But it seems like, you know, that's my name, don't wear it out, and all that kind of thing. They wore it out. Because And this is another thing I'll go ahead and say, because someone was asking in the chat room, and I didn't get a chance to answer the other day, why I'm not a 9/11 truther, and that's because I read Bamford, and I read Peter Lance, and I read Terry McDermott, and I read a hell of a lot of other reporters from all over the place, and I've been reading about Al-Qaeda from going back into the 1990s, and I think Al-Qaeda did it. However, I slept in that day. I woke up at like 3 o'clock because I worked nights at the time. But at least for the chance I had, I would have been the very first one to say that if they didn't do it, they didn't arrange it with the Saudis, or if they didn't deliberately look the other way, that just wait for how they exploit it. They might as well have done it, the U.S. government, I mean, for the cynicism that they employed in order to exploit the 9/11 attacks in order to carry out their preconceived agendas. And it was unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. And so it is believable that it was an inside job. I could see why so many people, when they look at how Dick Cheney and the neoconservative guys basically did, I mean, they were elected, sort of, kind of. Cheney was, anyway, with Bush, sort of, kind of. But with the neocons, they basically just, as Colin Powell even put it, they created a separate government inside the government. Douglas Feith's Gestapo office was how Colin Powell himself, the Secretary of State at the time, referred to the fake intelligence operation going on over in the Pentagon, where they were coming up with the lies to get us into war. And it was only because Powell would have resigned and was begging and crying George Bush that they even went to the United Nations at all. They were going to just go ahead and attack Iraq and then on from there. That was their plan. Regime change in Iran, regime change in Syria, and, you know, the whole Wesley Clark shtick, as they said. And they have followed up on some of this, right? Lebanon, they tried in Lebanon with a Cedar Revolution there in 05. And they certainly have gotten their regime change in Somalia, if not Sudan, or North Korea. But anyway. And, they had no right to do any of those things. And they had no right to lie to the American people. They had no right to lead the American people to believe. I mean, Dick Cheney and the neocons, they told the lie. Most of the rest of the government just sort of would have you go ahead and misunderstand them, that they were blaming Saddam for the attack. 70%, you can look up the USA Today story, is still there on the internet to this day, where 70% of the American people believed that Saddam had done 9/11. And they made it up themselves, mostly. I mean, they heard some stuff like that from some neocons on TV and that kind of thing. But for the most part, what it was they rationalized it. Like that guy in my cab. Come on. If Saddam didn't do it, then why would we be attacking him? You dumb cabbie. You can't be right about this. You see the cognitive dissonance there. It's easier to say, well, I must be uneducated, and there must be something that he can't remember, but that does prove that Saddam did it. Or else, come on, you're telling me that the USA would start a war, would attack a country that didn't do it? And so he wasn't really quoting Bush or Powell or Rice. He was just making it up. He was rationalizing it himself. And I asked him, same guy I've told his story a million times, hey man, how come they're waiting a year and a half then? Why are they waiting a year and a half? They didn't wait a year and a half. They wait a month and a half to attack Afghanistan. Now, that's kind of curious. But why would they be waiting a year and a half to attack Iraq, dude? If it was to get them back for 9/11, why would they be going through this rigmarole of begging permission from the Russians and the French on the UN Security Council to let us do it? Nah, it must have been. And the Republicans were perfectly happy to have everybody believe those lies. And now think about that. Maybe it is someone, you know, in your life or in your family or something like that, who was a real person who was killed there that day. And then you got to deal with The fact that the government, supposedly your government, as though we the people own it or any of that crap, then exploit your friend, your loved one, your family member's death in order to justify expanding an entire terror war across the Middle East? Man, seems like that's pretty sinful, guys. I'm not much of a religious type, but I would bet that if there's Jesus, he's gonna beat your ass for that. You know, someday after you die of natural causes on your giant estate, surrounded by your loved ones who consider you the salt of the earth, you know. But yeah, war crimes, man. Here's some footnotes. You want some footnotes about how they might as well have done it because of how cynical their evil, lying exploitation of the September 11th attacks was? You could read The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger. You typing that in now? The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger in The Guardian there. And then there's Agents of Influence by Bob Dreyfus in The Nation. And then there's The Lie Factory by Bob Dreyfus and Jason Vest in Mother Jones. And then there's Pentagon Home Office to Neocon Network by Jim Loeb for Interpress Service. And then there's How the Neoconservatives Conquered Washington and Launched a War by Michael Lind. You know that guy Michael Lind that wrote all that ridiculous trash at Salon.com about libertarianism? Anyway, he wrote this great thing. It's on antiwar.com, actually, the libertarian site. Antiwar.com, How the Neoconservatives Conquered Washington and Launched a War. And then, of course, you could read Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker. The Stovepipe is one, The Stovepipe by Seymour Hersh, and then also Selective Intelligence. They call themselves, self-mockingly, The Cabal. And, yeah, that's exactly what they are. And then, a little bit more background. You could read The Clean Break and read all the PNAC documents. They're at Information Clearinghouse. They've kept Rebuilding America's Defenses, which is the most important of the PNAC documents. But you can read also all their letters to Clinton and Bush demanding that they attack Iraq and regime change Iraq, etc. Whoa. Sorry, I forgot. Fox News time. Well, anyway, I already blew the damn break. So anyway, I guess that's all I have to say about that. Although, well, I guess the one more thing I could say is, yeah, I mean, hey, I'm suspicious still that somebody or another in the Bush administration may have possibly worked with Saudi intelligence to get the 15 guys on the planes and into the country to help with the attack, or at least look the other way, or at least that maybe there was kind of a thing in the wind, like we're going to go ahead and let the next one through. Looked like Prince Turkey's wife sent some money to a couple of the hijackers living with Al-Bayoumi, the FBI informant in San Diego. That's problematic. Looks like a lot of Saudi funding and the newly revealed safe house down in Florida and this kind of thing. Could that be directly tied to Houston Republicans, George W. Bush administration Republicans, in cooperation with the Saudis on a plot to go ahead and get one big one and justify a bunch of bad stuff? It's possible. I guess I'd give it 60 to 40. But then again, those Al-Qaeda guys, each of them is an individual, and man acts, as you should be well aware. And a lot of people have their own agency and their own hatreds and their own motivations. And I think if you read Terry McDermott in Perfect Soldiers, there's not too much question about who the Hamburg cell of pilot hijackers were and where they came from and who put them up to it and why they did what they did. I mean, that's just not a mystery that needs solving to me. And I don't think it will be to you if you read. It's Mohammed Atta wanted to try to kill you or whoever he could, or destroy the biggest symbol of American power that he could, as revenge for American support for Israel in their permanent occupations of Palestine and southern Lebanon. That's Mohammed Atta's life story. Okay, that's what you need to know about why 9/11 happened. It was revenge for American support for Israel. And better, it was a plan, worse, it was a plan to lure the American government, like a big, dumb bull into chasing the red flag, you know, to mix metaphors, I guess, off the cliff. Into the, or I guess first into the Matador's sword, and then off the cliff. And the Americans fell for it, just as bin Laden knew they would. And in fact, one more footnote, as long as I'm blowing the break here. Bin Laden's son, a non-jihadist son, told Rolling Stone in 2010 his father was ecstatic when Bush won the Florida recount thing, because he knew that this little pansy is, and I don't mean that in a sexual way, but I just mean in a has everybody else always do his fighting for him kind of a way. This little pretend tough guy, this little pretend cowboy, George W. Bush, is going to be so easy to bait into doing all of his worst bidding. Ha ha ha, with glee, the evil terrorist cackled. And sorry if I believe that as being the most believable thing anybody ever said to me before, because that's what it sounds like to me when I read that. Oh, man, and now I'm supposed to get Gareth on, and I'm talking still, so now I gotta go. Man, I had so much more stuff I was going to talk about on the show today, too. Eh, that's all right. Hang tight right here. Gareth Porter coming up. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And, man, I ran that whole check disk. The computer started back up again, and the first thing it says is, detected a hard disk problem. Yeah, that's why I ran the check disk. Weren't you supposed to fix that, you dumb thing? Anyway, who cares? Who cares? I'm just stalling for time as I pull up my email program here, that's all. We'll hope that the computer doesn't blow up live on the air, but maybe it will. That'll be fine. Stream will still work. But anyway, on to our next guest. Our next guest is the great Gareth Porter, and he's got a brand new one out at Truth Out. No, it's not. It's at IPS News, ipsnews.net. U.S. political breakout demand could derail nuclear talks. Well, breakout demand, I think I know what you mean there, Gareth, but why does political get scare quotes? Welcome back to the show. What's going on here?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me back again, Scott, and I'll explain the scare quote, or at least the quotes around political. It was very deliberate. I talked to my editor about this. We went back and forth a minute or so, and agreed that it was justified because in the article I basically quote the primary source of the whole idea that the United States is going to is in fact perhaps at this point already done it, but a few days ago was planning to demand a steep cut in the number of centrifuges that Iran now possesses, on the basis of something called the breakout theory, or the breakout argument, and this it turns out to be an extremely political notion. It's not objective, it's not neutral, it's not just technical. It's really a tool that has been used very effectively by hardliners to essentially press the United States policy in the direction of taking such a hard line in the talks that it makes agreement with Iran on the nuclear issue virtually impossible, if not simply impossible. And I think that, you know, my theory, I didn't say this in the piece, but my theory is that that has indeed been behind most, if not all, of the writing about breakout in the last few years. So that's what political is all about in this context.
All right. Now, so, well, let me put it this way. Does the IAEA have a dictionary, a glossary definition of breakout? Because it seems like if you wanted to, you could say that Iran has enough ore in the ground that they could have 1,500 nuclear weapons. And well, they're only 10 years or they're only 3 years. I don't know. Hey, let's. I don't know. I don't know the technical details, but I don't know. Let's say they really had a process and they wanted to double, triple, quadruple down and bust ass and convert as much of that uranium ore to yellow cake and then refine it and turn it into uranium hexafluoride gas and then enrich it. Maybe they could make, I don't know, this many hundred bombs in this much amount of time. Where on that scale is a breakout capability?
The breakout capability is defined. Everyone, you know, does understand what is meant in strict technical terms by a breakout capability. It measures the amount, it measures the two things, the amount of high-enriched uranium or weapons-grade uranium that could be produced in a given period of time, or how long it would take to produce enough high-enriched uranium or weapons-grade uranium for a single bomb, okay? That's from the time that this theoretical decision by Iran or whatever, you know, government is in question here to have a bomb, to at least have the high-enriched uranium for a bomb. So it's an amount, it assumes an amount of high-enriched uranium for a single bomb, and it says how long would it take them to enrich that once the decision's made. So it doesn't include all the other stuff, okay? It doesn't include what comes before, it doesn't include what comes after, and in my story, I point out that there's still a lot that remains to be done to actually have a weapon after you've got the amount of high-enriched uranium. That just gives you high-enriched uranium. And I quote a senior Iranian official who was quoted in the International Crisis Group report that just came out last week, saying essentially that everybody knows who's serious that even if Iran actually wanted to get a nuclear weapon, you know, they wouldn't be able to have one for years and years. I mean, this idea that, you know, breakout is going to take a few weeks or a few months, it's meaningless, essentially, is the significance of what he was saying. And that's really why I argue that it's political and misleading.
Well, now, so Gordon Prather tells me that, I forget, you know, the number, but there's some minimum amount that you would need. But once you have enough weapons-grade uranium, you know, really above 94%, people say 90, but it's really above 94% that you need. But then at that point, it's a relatively simple process to make a Hiroshima bomb as compared to a Nagasaki bomb, and not just the difference between uranium and plutonium, but the difference between a gun-type nuke versus an implosion system. And in the Hiroshima bomb, basically, the reason the bomb was so big is because there's a giant shotgun barrel in there, and it's shooting a uranium bullet at a uranium target, basically, and you do it hard enough. They didn't even test the bomb. They knew it would work. Because it was such a simple technology to use and to do. And then the test in Nevada, the Trinity test, that was a test of the Nagasaki bomb, which was much more complicated in timing the implosion system and everything like that. So I don't know exactly how long. They would need metallurgists to form. They would need explosives, and they would need the metallurgists to make the target and the uranium bullet, basically the uranium shotgun slug, I guess you could call it. But I don't think that part of it would really be the difficult part. The difficult part would be making the weapons grade uranium in front of God and everybody and getting away with it without the U.S. and Israel starting the carpet bombing campaign before you're able to do a damn thing with any of it.
That, of course, is the primary point. That while you're, you know, first of all, the story points out, and it quotes Gary Seymour, the former WMD advisor to President Obama, who quit the government a year ago last January and who is now at Harvard, And no, as you well know, and I think most of your listeners who are familiar with the name know, he's no dove on the issue of Iran's nuclear program. He's a real hawk. But he doesn't have too much to say that's good about the idea of breakout as it applies to this situation. And he points out that, you know, breakout only applies when you're talking about, you know, using the officially declared facilities. And that's because that's the only scenario, using officially declared facilities is the only scenario where you can actually measure how much centrifuges they have, and you can tell how good the centrifuges are, how effective they are, and so you can make some kind of rough prediction about how long it would take to enrich the weapons-grade uranium that's required. But if you're talking about a secret facility, which is what somebody like David Albright likes to talk about, then you can't talk about any time period. There's no way of knowing.
Yeah, because at that point, you're just making stuff up. And they've said this for years. Well, this is a real drawback, a reason why it may be very tough to do a bombing campaign is because, you know, we don't know where all their different nuclear facilities are. Yeah, in other words, the ones that you've imagined that you have no evidence exist anywhere.
Yeah, and so the point here that Seymour makes is that we're talking about a scenario where they're basically just signaling to the world, okay, we're going to have a nuclear weapon now. We're starting to defy or simply kick out the IAEA, and we're signaling that we're in the process of enriching uranium to weapons-grade levels. I mean, it's a stupid idea because, as I say, you know, at the end of however many months it takes them, they have so much high-enriched uranium, but what are they going to do with it? Then they've got years and years to try to get to a bomb that they can use. So, I mean, it's a stupid idea. And in fact, I quote Jim Walsh from MIT's Security Studies program saying, you know, this whole idea that they're going to race for a bomb, and not have anything that they can use while they face the threat of a war is silly.
Of course. All right, I'm sorry. We got to hold it right there and take this damn break. Hard breaks are programmed right in there. It's the great Gareth Porter from IPSnews.net. We're talking about Iran's nuclear program and the nuclear talks and the Americans sabotaging their own damn talks. Hold it.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got you, Gareth Porter, back on the show. We're talking about the Iran nuclear program here. And his new article at IPSnews.net is titled U.S. Political Breakout Demand Could Derail Nuclear Talks. And now, Gareth, I know you've been too smart to be optimistic about these talks all along, but I sort of got this feeling like, man, they really have gone so much farther out on a limb. And I mean the Americans in this negotiation, just in having it, compared to politics, not compared to what's, you know, decent or reasonable, but just compared to, you know, I don't know, the Bush years or something like that. It seems like, God dang, and I keep hearing, you know, very optimistic statements from American officials who think that, nah, you know, this time we're really, you know, we're going to have this worked out. Phil Giraldi even said that during the talks, the kind of secret background talks going on in Oman, that the CIA was there and they were doing all the game theory on the breakout, and they were basically already seeing eye to eye with these guys on what would be acceptable to us and what would be acceptable to them. So maybe is it possible that all this tough guy posturing about the Americans saying they would have to reduce their centrifuges this much and the Iranians saying, hell no, we're going to increase our centrifuges that much, that maybe that this is all just bluster that they've arranged so that they can work it out in the final deal and work out a final deal? Please say yes now.
Well, I'm not saying that it's inconceivable, Scott, but and I certainly have thought about that a lot, trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean? In the context of all that you've just talked about and more, you know, the degree to which the atmospherics have changed, you know, over the last, 9 months or so. The problem that I have is this, or maybe there's more than one problem, but it's a cluster of problems that are closely related. The question that I would ask is, if indeed the United States intends to make a deal and so sort of has a clear idea of the path to that deal, as suggested by the sort of things that you just mentioned, why would you feel it necessary to say out loud the United States is going to demand that Iran reduce its centrifuges by, you know, three-fourths or four-fifths or whatever, in order to, you know, increase the breakout time to a given arbitrary level of, let's 6 months as a minimum, maybe even more than that. What's the point of that? I mean, why do they need to commit themselves, not formally, but through the political process, obviously, of leaking things through this guy Robert Einhorn, who the former proliferation specialist of the State Department in the Obama administration. Why do they need to do that? It makes it more difficult to draw back from that position than if you say we are not able to talk about what our negotiating position is. There's an agreement on both sides that we will not do that. The Iranians have, of course, made some general statements at this point about their need for more centrifuges, but they've not said what their negotiating position is going to be. And in this case, we see the Obama administration doing precisely that. I mean, they're telegraphing it in advance unnecessarily, and I interpret that as a signal that they are responding to what they regard as some very compelling political considerations, as well as a very strong conviction that the United States cannot live with less than what they're talking about. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I've put it together.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. I mean, the whole thing here, too, though, is, I mean, never mind that. Oh, and I'm sorry, Gareth, I completely neglected both intros here to mention that you wrote the book on this. Manufactured crisis. It's all a bunch of crap. They never were making nukes in the first place. They never were trying. It's all a tempest in a teapot. That's the subtitle. Manufactured crisis. It's at Amazon.com. The real history of the Iran nuclear program and what it isn't. And by the great Gareth Porter. Please go and buy 100 copies and send them around to all the libraries in your state. But so, okay, pretend for a minute that I was some Republican and you had to talk me out of wetting the bed here about how terrified I am about what Iran might do if they had a nuke or whatever. How much time does the U.S. Navy need to start airstriking Iran? 45 minutes? Something
yeah, right,
like that?
Exactly.
What the hell am I worried about a breakout capability? What difference does it make if their breakout capability, and this is assuming the Empire's prerogative to bomb whoever they feel like, by the way, not my own standard for starting a war. Seriously, what difference does it make if they're within 2 months of making a bomb all the time if they were to break out, or whether they're within 2 years? Because we could just as easy start an aggressive war against them, and who's going to stop us? Russia?
I mean, that is the right question to ask, Scott, and the answer is that it doesn't make any difference. And this is an interesting little point that I didn't put in my article, but I think it's very relevant to precisely this, to the point that you've just made. At a forum or at a panel discussion at the U.S. Institute of Peace, quote unquote, in Washington yesterday, which I did in fact attend, this guy, Colin Call, who was formerly at the Defense Department, the top Middle East specialist there at the Defense Department in the Obama administration, is now back at the think tank, the pro-military think tank where he originally came from. He said something after Robert Einhorn had made his presentation talking about breakout. He said, well, it's just worth pointing out at this point that the Obama administration has been living under a breakout of less, you know, far less than 6 months for the past four or six years, but anyway, for several years. I think you said 4 years. And you said just a data point. The obvious significance of that is that, you know, this is not something new. It just shows that Iran is not trying to race for a bomb. I mean, you know, if they were going to race for a bomb, why wouldn't they have done it already? Instead of racing for it, they've walked away from it by, as I think many people know, they have, in fact, reduced their stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, which would have been the primary asset that they would have available to race for a bomb if that's what they were going to do.
All right, now, okay, but, and I'm sorry because we have very little time to talk about this, Garrett, just, 3 minutes here or something, but, so, I kind of got this attitude, which perhaps is completely ridiculously unfounded here, but that, you know, maybe, I mean, god dang, why would they be doing this at all unless they thought there was a good enough chance that they could do this and, I mean, get the nuclear deal signed? Why would they be going through the rigmarole unless they really thought they could get the nuclear deal signed? And why would they even be interested enough in actually getting a nuclear deal signed? This is my slippery slope argument. I can already hear it. Why would they be interested enough to actually get this much work done and get a nuclear deal unless their plan was, we're going to go ahead and end the Cold War with Iran. We're going to begin to break this ice and work these things out and end the old regime of American-Iranian politics and figure out something else. I mean, what the hell better way to protect Israel from the menace of the Shiite crescent than to befriend the Iranians? They'll never be our Shah Reza Pahlavi sock puppet dictatorship again, but we could have a sort of China relationship with them and respect their independence and trade.
Perfect sense.
Isn't that what they're doing, though? Isn't that why Obama has done this? Is because he's decided he's going to China. He's doing it slow, and he's not doing it effectively enough for my wishes. But isn't that what's going on here or not?
No. Because, I mean, the Nixon going to China was a special case, a special concatenation of circumstances where they could make a major strategic shift on the basis of a conscious sort of geopolitical analysis. But this Obama administration doesn't do that. That's not the way they act. That's not the way they operate. I mean, what's really going on is what Obama has always done, which is he's making it up as he goes along, responding to political pressures from both the bureaucratic interest, the powerful bureaucratic interest that we've talked about so often on your show, and the powerful domestic political interests that come from money from the from the pro-Israeli folks in this country. So, I mean, it's the combination of those two forces that have shaped the U.S. policy toward Iran and continue to shape it. But at the same time, of course, Obama, you know, has an interest in trying to put off a crisis over this issue as much as possible to try to damp it down. And so, you know, it makes sense for him to sit down and negotiate it. It kicks the can down the road. It prevents the situation from getting out of hand. It prevents the prices of oil from going up, dramatically. All those things are gained by going ahead with negotiations. But do they have a clear-cut end state that would resolve this crisis? I don't think so.
That's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. IPSnews.net. Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks again, Scott.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.